virtual meeting of the Health and Human Services Finance Division to order. I'm going to just start out, since this is the first time this committee has met remotely. I know that a lot of members have been doing this with other committees and kinds of meetings, but first of all, we're going to ask members to mute their feeds. This works much better if everyone is on mute. And so we're going to ask you to stay muted during the hearing and to raise your hand if you would like to ask a question. And then once you do that, leave the hand raised until we get the one of our hosts, either Mr. McQuillan or Ms. Niedernhofer, who are managing this remote hearing. They will put your hand down. So just put it up there if you have a question and then leave it there. So today, as members probably know, we are going to be talking about testing related to the COVID-19 crisis. The purpose of the hearing is to understand better how testing can be used to help with the crisis and what the limits of that testing might be. We're going to hear some short presentations, first from the Department of Health, that's going to give us a good overview of testing and how it can be used, how it's being used in the state. And then we're going to hear short presentations from three of Minnesota's great institutions about their ability to provide what Minnesota needs in the way of testing and what the limitations of that might be. I want to acknowledge at the outset what many of you probably know, which is that all three of these institutions have presented proposals for how Minnesota might partner with them in providing this testing. We are not hearing those proposals today. I want to emphasize that. This is not a hearing to evaluate any particular institution's request for funding. That will come at a different time. What we are doing is focusing today on the general topic so that we can fulfill our responsibilities as legislators to help Minnesota get through this as best we can while managing Minnesota's resources as best we can. So that's the purpose of the hearing today. I expect it's going to be extremely interesting. We're going to call the roll now, but the way we're going to do this is since Ms. Niedernhofer, our legislative committee legislative assistant, can see who's on the call, I'm going to ask her to just simply note for us who is on the call. She's going to note the roll. You don't have to respond. And then at the end, if your name is not called, if we missed you for some reason, I'm going to ask you to raise your hand so that we can note that you're present on the call. I hope that'll work better than having a sort of a roll call procedure. So Ms. Niedernhofer, if you can do that, please go ahead.
Hi. I have Liebling, Mann, Schumacher, Akam, Baker, Ehrman, Cantrell, Franson, Grunhagen, Haley, Hamilton, Jordan, Keel, Kunish-Padin, Moran, Munson, Noor, and Schultz.
All right. Is there anybody who is on the call, a committee member who was missed?
I just see Liz Olson just joined. So.
Okay.
Did you say Moran?
Yes.
Oh, okay.
I did.
All right. Thank you. All right. Anyone else whose name was not called? All right. And I think a quorum is present, although I didn't get the official on that, but it sure sounds like
yes.
A quorum is present. So yes. Wonderful. Thank you. So the first thing we have to do is approve some minutes, one of those mundane tasks. So we have the minutes that have been sent out to everyone of February 27th, March 3rd, and March 4th. And we can approve these with a voice vote. Is there a motion to approve these three sets of minutes?
So moved, Madam Chair.
All right. Representative Cantrell moves to approve the minutes of February 27th, March 3rd, and March 4th. Is there any discussion to the minutes? Okay, seeing none. and everyone should be unmuted right now. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye. Opposed, no.
All right. Thank you, members. The minutes are approved. All right, then. Let's get right to our testifiers. First up, we're really happy to have Dan Hoff, who is the Assistant Commissioner at MDH for the Health Protection Bureau. And we really appreciate his being here today. As you all know, the department is extremely busy managing the crisis, and he's made time for us to be here today and has also given us a presentation that I hope we're going to be able to put on the screen for you while he gives us his presentation. So, Mr. Hoff, please go ahead.
Thank you, Madam Chair, committee members. I wanted to provide an overview of testing. It's definitely a hot topic right now, and then hopefully be able to answer any questions you may have. Next slide, please. So when we talk about testing related to COVID, we're really talking about two different types, molecular testing and serologic or serology. Next slide, please. So molecular tests are used to diagnose a current infection, and they actually test for the presence of the virus that causes COVID-19. And it does this by detecting the viral RNA. These are done in a certified lab, these type of tests. For example, the MDH Public Health Lab does these. And the way the sampling works here is a doctor or a clinician actually takes a swab either from the back of the throat or up the nose to the back of the throat, which is uncomfortable, but that's what gives us the best, amount of stuff for a viral test. The test results will vary. We can get false negatives. That's dependent upon the viral load of the individual, how long have they been infected, the collection technique. So up through the nose and back is better than just the back of the throat. But even, there's just variability there. And then obviously there can be sometimes lab errors or lab sensitivity issues. But most of that varies from the viral load of the individual and collection. And we can have up to 70% false negatives with that. So there are limitations. Okay, next slide, please. So the serologic test, this test antibodies that the that your body has produced, not the virus, but rather your response of your immune system. And because it can take a while for the antibodies in your system to build up, these tests are not really, they're not most effective until about 14 days after antibodies have been produced. Every day subsequent to the infection, you produce more. And depending on how much is in the blood sample, you have to have a pretty good load of those antibodies to test positive on these tests. The tests that we're hearing about coming out so much now, where there's like same day tests, you just go through and you can get this tested anywhere. Most of these are these serologic tests. Now, one of the concerns, depending on the test specificity, some of these tests will react with other human coronaviruses. So there are some human coronaviruses that cause seasonal colds. Most of us have had them. And you'll have antibodies for those. And therefore, if the test is not specific to the COVID-19 virus, then it'll act like you have had it when in fact you've just had one of these colds. So that is a concern. It is a blood test. There are a lot of products in the market. The FDA, in a desire to get as much testing out there as possible, has really streamlined the approval, which means there's not the usual rigor for FDA approval of these tests. They still have to be performed at a certified lab. Doesn't mean that they're collected at a certified lab, but they still have to be at a CLIA certified lab where the test is actually performed. Next slide, please. So we use molecular tests for clinical use to diagnose someone. It's also used by MDH staff, our disease investigation team. When we get a positive test, we follow up with that individual, make sure that they're in isolation, and that any people who have come in close contact with them are quarantined for 14 days. It also helps us to protect vulnerable populations. For example, we're really doing a lot of sampling and testing in long-term care facilities to protect those folks. And it can also help with surveillance. What is the prevalence of the disease within our community of the infection within Minnesota, and what is the rate at which that infection is growing? Next slide. So the serologic test, we have a lot to learn about this disease. We assume, as with most viruses, that if you have the virus once, then you gain immunity from it, or at least some sense of immunity. Now, this hasn't been tested because the virus hasn't been around long enough for us to really determine that as to how long our immunity lasts. As you know, with a lot of our vaccines, you have to get a booster shot to boost that immune response back up. So we are inferring that there is protective immunity here. And this can also then help us indicate, if this is accurate, how much herd immunity we have. So the idea that if most of the majority of the population are immune, it shouldn't have ways to continue broad spread in it. These are not for diagnostic testing. Okay, next slide, please. So our testing strategy in Minnesota is to dramatically ramp up testing. It is not just to test for numbers, but rather to do it strategically. It's for a number of reasons. In addition to the clinical reasons for medical care, it also helps us with our surveillance. What's the prevalence and the rate of spread within Minnesota? It helps us really protect vulnerable populations, as well as the staff serving vulnerable populations and healthcare workers. And then it helps us do this disease investigation, which is isolation and quarantine. Next slide, please. So right now we are prioritizing molecular testing because there has been limitations or limits to the amount of tests that we have in the state. Upon these criteria, with our most our highest priority being those who are in long-term care settings, shelters, prisons, those people who are in congregate housing. And you can see the whole list here that we are really prioritizing testing. We want to expand testing to make sure that we are testing every one of these populations, but there are other areas of the population we want to expand to. For example, critical infrastructure workers, such as utility workers or people that may work in a food plant, et cetera. Next slide. So this is my little diagram, and as people know me, I like analogies. So I want you to picture yourself. We're in a truck. We're at the top of a mountain. We got a very curvy mountain road to go down with no guardrails. And we are right now kind of at the top of the mountain, and we got to get down to the bottom of the mountain, which is basically getting us out of this disease. We hope that there will be an off-ramp, which is a vaccine or more effective treatment. But right now there's no off-ramp. We got to get down the mountain. It's dark. We don't have headlights. Testing gives us some headlights. So in the early phase right now, we're very fortunate because of the early implementation of these broad community mitigation measures. We have the lowest prevalence of the disease and the lowest rate of infection of any of the 50 states, and actually including District of Columbia, we're number 51. But we do need to get through this. So if you could click, I've got a little animation here. As we go down the mountain, go ahead and click again. These type of tests give us some headlights, if you will. The molecular tests, that is how quickly people are becoming infected, that gives us an idea of how fast we're going. If we get going too fast, we go off the cliff. And what that means is we crash our healthcare system. It means that we have so many people getting infected that we end up like New York City, where we're rationing beds, we're rationing ventilators, and basically choosing who dies and who lives. And that's not the situation we want to be in. That's why we have to make sure we keep our foot in the brakes. Molecular testing will give us an idea of how quickly the rate is spreading. There's a limitation here because it takes about 2 to 3 weeks after someone is infected before they become symptomatic, and then they seek healthcare and then actually get tested. So we won't see the cliff until, or rather, when we see the cliff, we have to press the brakes for 2 to 3 weeks before we can actually slow down enough not to go over the cliff. Serologic testing, theoretically, would show us how far down the mountain we are, how many people had been or have had the infection. So that gives us an idea of within our population, how many people have already passed the virus, their immune system has recovered from it. That gives us an idea of how far we are down towards herd immunity. Okay, next slide, please. This gives you an idea of our testing rate in Minnesota. Today, we had over 1,400 tests performed, and the MDH Public Health Lab was the only show in town at the beginning because of the way CDC rolled out the test, and at one point, we tested over 800 samples in a day. It's very unusual for us as a public health lab. We're not a high-throughput lab. We're a specialty lab. So now what we're doing is we're testing those most vulnerable populations in congregate care settings. And we're relying upon other labs, those that are that hospital systems have developed themselves, or what we call reference labs. These are the commercial labs, such as Mayo in Minnesota, but also some national labs, such as LabCorp and Quest. Okay, next slide, please. This puts us per our rate of testing per our population about 32nd within the country. Each one of those gray squiggly lines represents another state. And I believe that the top state is New York, if I'm correct. Next slide, please. If you'd like additional information on how, especially our clinical guidance on testing, it is available on our website, and I just have the whole website dialed out. Okay, and with that concludes my presentation. Thank you, Madam Chair and representatives.
All right, well, thank you so much, Mr. Hupp. And I forgot to mention at the outset of this, I would like members to hold questions if possible. Unless there's something that needs clarification, this is the procedure we've used in the past in our committee. And with this awkward virtual meeting format, it will be especially important here. So if you have any questions right now, just on clarification of what Mr. Hupp told us, please let me know. Otherwise, we'll go on to our other testifiers. And I would just ask members to note your questions down, so that we can, we're asking Mr. Hupp if he can stay with us to be available to answer questions at the end. And we'll ask our other testifiers to do that as well. So I'm not seeing any questions right now that are clarifying. So thank you very much. I think that's extremely interesting. And there's actually quite a bit to digest there. So with that, we will move on to our next testifier, who is Scott Beck, who's a senior vice president at Mayo Clinic Laboratories. Mr. Beck, or Dr. Beck, are you on the call?
Madam Chair, members and guests, can you hear me okay?
Yes.
Good. And Madam Chair, it is Mr. Beck. I have two roles. One is to function as the administrator for our Department of Laboratory Medicine and Pathology here at Mayo Clinic. I serve alongside Dr. Bill Maurice, who's also joined on the call here today. We provide laboratory medicine and pathology support services for Mayo Clinic Rochester, as well as throughout the Mayo Clinic Health System. Our second title reflects the fact that we began extending our internal testing capabilities to external customers back in 1971 with the launch of what is now known as Mayo Clinic Laboratories. As Mr. Huff had suggested, we are a fully functioning commercial reference lab. From that perspective, we're the third largest reference lab in the country that provides support to 4,000 customers in 80 countries. We test about 25 million tests or conduct about 25 million tests a year. About 40,000 a day come through the airport in Rochester. And we currently are comprised of about 4,200 employees in Minnesota supporting both our internal department as well as Mayo Clinic Laboratories. A portion of those employees work in our virology lab, which began working on bringing up a molecular test, a PCR-based molecular test that Mr. Huff described, and launched that test for internal use on March 12th for testing within our health system. And then we made that test available through Mayo Clinic Laboratories a week later on March 19th. We currently have a capacity of around 7,500 tests per day and have conducted about 108,000 tests since inception, 25,000 of those for people within the state of Minnesota. To access that service through our health system, you go through a nurse screen line that has a series of questions and diagnostic to determine whether you are symptomatic. And if you are, they create an order and you're referred to a drive-through testing area where your swab is taken. And then you are provided the results of the test normally within 24 hours. If you are positive for that test, then our occupational health department begins to do what's called the contact tracing. And we'll begin to interview you and determine the contacts you've had with individuals 2 days prior to your first symptoms and through the date of the diagnostic. And then those individuals are then brought in for testing as well. And any of those that are tested positive are asked to quarantine themselves. Mr. Huff had brought up the serology testing as well, which is trying to measure the antibody immunity that comes from the diagnostic or from the disease itself. We began offering that serology test in April 6th internally and on April 10th externally to people through Mayo Clinic Laboratories. Our capacity is roughly 20,000 tests a day. And we are currently continuing to work on additional tests that we can bring up for other aspects of COVID-19 that haven't yet been needed, but will be shortly. And Dr. Maurice, my physician partner, will be talking through those.
Madam Chair and members, it's a real pleasure and honor to be able to join you and our other guests here today to discuss this really critical issue for the state. As Scott mentioned, I'm the chair of laboratory medicine and pathology and also the president of Mayo Clinic Laboratory, so I also hold that dual role that Scott spoke to. I've actually been in the Rochester community since 1987. I did all my training here at Mayo Clinic and raised my family here as well, and they live in the Twin Cities area of my adult children. So it's very important to all of us. Really, since the early days, as soon as we had the molecular PCR test available through Mayo Clinic Laboratories, we immediately pivoted to try and begin innovation efforts to get out ahead of this problem as much as we possibly could. We did leverage the Discovery Square building and the Advanced Diagnostic Lab in that Discovery Square building, which is actually an investment made in our community as part of the Destination Medical Center project. And we really then started to organize our innovation efforts along different corridors, if you will, or different foci of innovation. So the first was on serologic testing and also neutralizing antibodies, so not just testing for the presence of antibodies, but for their ability to neutralize the virus and its infectivity. The second was actually to look at beyond molecular testing for the virus itself, but to actually test for the proteins of the virus as opposed to the nucleic acids through antigen testing. The third is really to understand, can we use laboratory tools to identify those patients that are going to get seriously ill with COVID, recognizing that you know, with age distribution differences, that the majority of patients actually will not suffer from a severe illness, although clearly the public health measures we've taken are critically important for the reasons which were very well described by the first presentation. The next was really to look at point of care diagnostics, because knowing as soon as possible when someone is infected is critically important. That has suffered from some of the same. That's been a focus of ours. It's been challenging to get industry collaborations there just because so many are focused on the same thing. The other initiative, and this was actually in collaboration with Biotechni, which is another company based actually in the Twin Cities, which we had a relationship with and do still, is to look at tissue diagnostics for the virus itself. I think this will be really critically important. We've seen questions raised now about how many of the patients who succumb who are SARS-CoV-2 positive actually have COVID disease as a cause of death. And so this is one of the main reasons. Also, as we get into looking that we're going to be living with this virus, it will be important in transplantation of solid organs, including the lung and other tissues, to understand if the virus is present before you give it to an immunocompromised host. So that's been a focus of ours. And then most recently, we've been focused on actually the data and the analytics, because as the great analogy of getting down that mountain, the more data that we have to illuminate our path and to really understand, the real concern is the lack of guardrails. And if we get one tire off the road, because if we don't have we don't have a bright enough path, that's going to be really challenging for the state, because in part our mitigation efforts have been so effective. So that's really been the focus, and we're really trying to take a thoughtful approach all the way along in terms of how we can help contribute whatever we in any way we can to protect our state and our people.
So, Dr. Maurice, thank you very much for that. And I hope that you and Mr. Beck can hang around for a little bit in case there are questions. I do see that we have one question from Representative Bierman. And if it's a clarifying question, I think we could take that now. But if it's a more of a substantive question, I think we'd like to hold off. Representative Bierman?
Madam Chair, we can wait until the end.
Okay, thank you. All right. Well, excellent. So next, we're going to deviate from our agenda just a little bit. I understand that Dr. Tolar, who is next, is having a little technical difficulty. So if Dr. Hoodie from Hennepin Healthcare is ready, we could go to Dr. Hoodie. Do we have Dr. Hoodie on the line?
Yes, Madam Chair, this is Dr. Hoodie. Can you hear me okay?
Yes, welcome.
Thank you. One second here.
And when you get, just if you would just introduce yourself for us and then go ahead when you're ready.
Yeah, Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Dan Hoodie. I'm the Interim Chief Medical Officer for Hennepin Healthcare System. As many of you know, Hennepin Healthcare is an integrated system of care that includes a nationally recognized level one trauma center and a clinic system with primary care clinics located across Hennepin County. Almost half of our patient population qualifies for Medicaid for their healthcare, and one in five of our primary care patients are experiencing housing instability. Can you still hear me?
Yes.
Okay, great. One second, sorry. Sixty percent of our patient population is non-white, and 20% prefer a language other than English. Many are particularly vulnerable to chronic health issues, food insecurity, and frequent transportation challenges. Our 7,000 employees proudly provide care for patients from all over Minnesota, much like the other healthcare systems.
Madam Chair, we lost
his
audio.
Okay, I'm still hearing Dr. Hoodie. Who was it that's not hearing? Okay, I think we're okay. Sometimes okay. Our own connection goes in and out as well, but I think we're still okay. Please continue.
Okay, well, I'll keep going. Thank you, Madam Chair. Our 7,000 employees proudly provide care for patients from all over Minnesota. Much like the other healthcare systems testifying here today, we at Hennepin are on the front lines of the COVID-19 pandemic. We're treating patients with COVID-19, and we have healthcare workers who have been exposed to COVID-19. Before getting into the details of our testing at Hennepin, I want to make several points clear. First, the most effective strategy that we know of to reduce the transmission of COVID infection is social distancing. Second, the ability to social distance is in fact a privilege. Many Minnesotans are fortunate enough to be able to care for themselves, work from home, and live in low-density neighborhoods, all things that are amenable to social distancing. Other Minnesotans, however, don't share this privilege and are unable to effectively social distance. Examples include those workers on the COVID front lines, such as physicians, nurses, and healthcare workers, community and public health workforces, and all first responders, the elderly and disabled in congregate living facilities, and populations with lower socioeconomic status living in high-density neighborhoods. Third, the health outcome disparities associated with COVID-19 are real. In Chicago, nearly 70% of the COVID deaths are Black individuals, and yet Blacks make up only 30% of the population, and most of these deaths are concentrated in just five neighborhoods. Similar disparities have been observed in Louisiana, Michigan, and New York City. An op-ed published in the Journal of the American Medical Association just yesterday summed this issue up by stating the following. Even though the data is preliminary, the pattern is irrefutable. Underrepresented minorities are developing COVID-19 infection more frequently and dying disproportionately. So how does testing fit into the above 3 points? Let me give you an example. Recently, there was a cluster of COVID cases in a homeless shelter in Boston. In response to the outbreak, the Boston Healthcare for the Homeless conducted PCR testing, the same type of testing we offer at Hennepin, to all guests residing at the shelter over a two-day period. 36% of the residents tested positive, many of which were not experiencing any symptoms whatsoever. Available PCR testing here provided the opportunity for early intervention to prevent further exponential spread. These findings highlight how rapidly COVID can spread in a population unable to social distance and suggest that more widespread PCR testing strategy with rapid turnaround times could assist greatly in identifying and mitigating COVID-19 among patients living in high-density areas. To drive home the point here, more PCR testing availability can lead to more robust mitigation of COVID-19 among populations who do not have the ability or have the privilege of being able to social distance. We at Hennepin appreciate this relationship between the availability of PCR testing and health equity, and as a result, we extend our sincerest appreciation to the legislature for your investments in the Minnesota Department of Health that have been distributed to hospitals for our immediate needs. We were awarded $3.8 million for our molecular lab for the purpose of expanding COVID PCR testing. We're fortunate to have the lab expertise on site at Hennepin led by Glenn Hansen that has allowed us to leverage this investment to rapidly scale up molecular testing in a safe, effective, and reliable manner. Thanks to your help, we've been able to acquire the instruments and materials needed to process up to 600 COVID PCR tests per day and 4,200 per week. In addition to testing on our own patients, we currently provide tests for all affiliates of Hennepin County, including Healthcare for the Homeless Clinics, Hennepin County Public Health, and our jail and corrections. We are also processing tests for multiple health systems in the Twin Cities area and greater Minnesota, including the VA and the Indian Board of Health. Once specimens are received, we can offer a turnaround time of less than 24 hours. This rapid PCR turnaround time greatly assists with conservation of PPE in acute care settings, with identifying the most appropriate temporary housing situation for a homeless patient, and with deciding if valuable healthcare workers can return to work. We're currently testing all high-priority Minnesotans identified by the MDH list of priority groups, and we'll continue processing the tests for our external customers as well. Additionally, we're in the process of expanding specimen collection to several of our neighborhood clinics in Hennepin County. All of this is in an effort to combat both the COVID-19 pandemic that is impacting us now and the health disparities that have been impacting us for decades. In summary, I'd like to reemphasize several key points. Social distancing is currently the most effective strategy to reduce COVID infection, period. Populations who don't enjoy the privilege of being able to easily social distance include underrepresented minorities and healthcare workers. For those populations unable to social distance, increased availability of PCR testing can mitigate the impact of COVID-19. The 7,000 employees of Hennepin Healthcare consider it an honor and a privilege to provide care to many vibrant communities of the Twin Cities area and greater Minnesota. We look forward to continuing to expand our PCR testing capabilities and investigate additional serology testing opportunities. We're doing this not in an effort to garner headlines or maximize testing profit, but instead we are working to create a testing approach that promotes a healthy Minnesota for all citizens, not just those fortunate enough to be able to social distance. Thank you again for all you've done to address the needs of healthcare systems so we can do our best to take care of our communities. And thank you for allowing the time to testify today on behalf of Hennepin Healthcare and the community that we serve.
All right. Well, thank you very much, Dr. Hoodie. We appreciate you being able to be here today. And I have also Representative Keel has raised her hand. Is there a clarifying question, Representative Keel? Because we're going to try to get through all the testifiers before we go back to substantive questions. I think you're muted.
There you go. Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair. The question I would have for Dr. Hoodie is when you're testing different groups, maybe a congregate area, is the test being done to everyone, even those who, you know, the tests that you know someone is sick, but how about others around to see how far it spread?
Dr. Hoodie?
We are doing, Madam Chair. Thank you. We are doing contact tracing and testing as indicated at this point.
Okay.
Thank you.
All right. Let's thank you very much again, Dr. Hoodie. Thank you, Representative Keel. Dr. Tolar, welcome to the committee. If you could introduce yourself, and glad you got some technical issues straightened out, and glad you're here. Go ahead.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I'm delighted to be here. Yes, we are living these lives as we are disappearing into the phones and Zooms, you know, things of this nature will happen all the time. I serve as a dean of the medical school at the University of Minnesota and vice president of the University for the Clinical Affairs. Equally important, I am a bone marrow transplant physician, and I came here 30 years ago through Britain, across the Atlantic, to get my PhD, which is also relevant, here in molecular biology with a focus on virology. And I've always felt that Minnesota is a phenomenal state. And as Mr. Hoodie said, you know, we are fortunate that we have been able to be at the bottom of the list, how many cases per 100,000, approximately 20 we have. And I think we tie with Puerto Rico today at that bottom. And we are among 8 states in the United States that have less than 1 fatality per million of people. Now, the prognostication that you have been looking at and all the Twitter storms that have been everywhere are in most cases just incorrect. But that's, you know, the probabilistic, you know, that we can get into as we get into the intricacies of the testing. What is more important, I think, for the state of Minnesota is that we use the prognostication, we use the estimates as a way of changing them, because that is the major way whereby we can use prognostication. So because of that opportunity to change our future, to design the future that we want for the state, I have been charging my teams with, you know, shifting from being a victim in this pandemic, but rather being a vector and knowledgeable, conscious vector of this, and using societal and medical measures in equal share to change that kind of a retreat that we have seen in China, in Lombardy and in Seattle and New York to a point into an advance. And the way the University of Minnesota has, under your discipline and direction and your leadership, has been operated is have a comprehensive plan. Very disciplined and very comprehensive, because going after this pandemic is actually not that difficult. You isolate the contacts, you prioritize the treatment, and you develop vaccine. That's it. You know, we know how to do that. The problem is that the deploying this on scale and across the state of Minnesota is logistically and technically quite difficult. So what we knew from the very beginning that the supplies will be, when I say beginning, I say mid-February. When I saw the first CT scan on 29th of December, as an intensive care physician, I knew that this is different. I didn't know this is a pandemic. Of course not. But I knew that this is going to be quite different. And I also knew that even though everybody is using the unprecedented word, this is not unprecedented. This is the third coronavirus epidemic that we had just this century. So this is something that's keep coming back, and we actually know some of it. And back to Mr. Huff's comments, we actually do know a little bit about the antibody response from the previous SARS and MERS epidemics. But what we have designed is a way of having a synergy and confluence of about 5 different interactions. We knew that the protective equipment is going to be short-lived, that the supplies will go away and there's going to be price gouging and all that stuff. So we have designed with the Science and Engineering College here and College of Design and the medical school, we have designed from within the university a manufacturer of these face masks that we can use. And in fact, yesterday morning, we got an FDA approval for a very simple ventilator, because there is if you look at these predictions, there is this appropriately horrific image of having 50 patients on the floor and having 30 ventilators. And then the 20 that are without the ventilators and need it, you know, will die. And so we developed that ventilator, again, with our medical device center. That's the center that brought, you know, to Minnesota a pacemaker and other, you know, very important things, and spun, you know, many of the 19,500 Fortune companies we have around the state. And we've been able to get that technical stuff done. The second part was the clinical treatments. I really think that the proactive approach to this, you know, is incredibly important. And we have designed a study that spans the spectrum of the COVID-19 disease in a way that we have one study for prevention of the infection, then one for the early infection, and one for the very serious infection. And they are all national studies and enrolling very, very quickly. And we'll be able to answer the question, is this safe? Is this the right thing to do? And is this really something we need to do? And then with my partner in the mHealth Fairview, James Herford, we have put together a logistics enterprise that has vacated and created COVID-19 hospital. Because that's really very important, because you need to cohort people who have this disease so you can focus the healthcare workers around, you know, the population that has the COVID-19 disease. And also you can streamline the way you take care of them. So the COVID-19 hospital, you know, has been incredible advancement. And then lastly, I'm getting to the point of this discussion, which is the diagnostics and testing. Now, the molecular and serologic testing has been beautifully explained by Dan Huff, so I'm not going to go over this, but it's very important that they are understood for what they mean. Because this time, it seems, anytime you open any social media or any paper, everybody is an immunologist. And I think it's very difficult to really interpret some of this data unless you sort of have the context. So there are really three different scenarios that you can imagine in this spectrum if you subtract the first 10 to 14 days that it takes the immunity to develop an antibody to the virus. And we think that outside of the like my patients with bone marrow transplant or other immunocompromised individuals, we think that almost everyone actually does develop some kind of an antibody. What kind of a quality antibody, I'm happy to get into in the later discussion, but let's assume that you, if you have an antibody, you had that infection. But there are three different groups. There is going to be people who have antibody negative, you know, they have no response, and they don't have the virus. They are negative, if you will. These are susceptible. They need to be protected. That's very, very important component of the whole thing. The second group is the ones that are molecular PCR positive. So they, in that nasal swab that Dan Huff, you know, described, they will have the virus. And regardless of whether they have antibody positive or not, they are shedding it. They are spreading the infection in the community, whether they have or don't have symptoms. And we think about 25% people may be these asymptomatic, you know, not, they don't know that they have it, in other words. You know, people that spread the disease and may magnify the impact on the society. And then lastly are the ones that are antibody positive. They have the antibody and they are PCR negative. These are the people who have been immune because of the infection, because we don't have the vaccine yet. But these are the ones that would be least likely to be affected by the infection. And most the focus of any kind of a societal intervention that we want to do in the state of Minnesota. And we have a tremendous advantage of being able not only to have validated and qualified the molecular testing, that's the nucleic acid, that RNA polymerase chain reaction in-house at the university. So we have, you know, all the FDA approvals on this as well, and validation of the testing. So we can trust it, and we owe it to the community of Minnesota. We owe it to our patients, and we owe it to you as leaders that we actually deliver on this. On the antibodies, the same thing. And it's really important. We didn't buy it from somebody. We actually have had a group at this university, partly from veterinary medicine and partly from medical school, have a picture, an image of that virus, that coronavirus that has these little spikes. It looks like a chew toy for a dog, and an interaction with the receptor on the cell. And from that, we have taken that protein and developed an assay that measures the total amount of the protein, immune protein, we call it immunoglobulin, that is related to the virus itself. And we have been able to validate this inside house at the university, and we have been able to scale it now, get it approved by, you know, all the regulatory bodies, and then you know, plan on how to scale it up so that we can bring you the protection that is needed on the healthcare worker side, on the household contact, and then, you know, as Mr. Huff said, you know, go into the targeted population, being that a food plant, being that a nursing home, being that a tribal nation, you know, whatever the targeted population is. And in this way, we can have, with the full confidence in science and full confidence in the societal measures that you as leaders have taken, which I'm very, very grateful for, we can go in this and truly provide that testing in a widespread enough way so that we achieve the sort of a societal architecture that allows us to live through this epidemic and hopefully, you know, flatten the curve in a way, change the prognostication that we are getting in a way that we can truly respond, you know, with vigor and direct action to this epidemic. And I want to be very clear that the collaboration with Mayo Clinic has been very close from the very beginning. I have multitude of collaborations across these two academic institutions in the state, and I'd be happy to provide anything else, you know, that can serve this committee and this great state in being the example and being the center of solution and information and action hub for the whole United States. Madam Chair.
All right. Well, Dr. Tolar, thank you very much for that presentation. Really, we appreciate it. So we have about 45 minutes left in the hearing. So I think we've had a lot of information, and I'm sure this is not going to be the only time that we're going to have information like this presented. And also, I think that this is being recorded, so members will be able to go back and the public can go back and listen to some of these presentations as well. So we have a few members on the list. First of all, we'll go to Representative Bierman. And Representative Bierman, who are you wanting to ask a question of?
Thank you, Madam Chair. My question would be for Mr. Huff, please.
Okay, please continue.
This is in regards to the slides we are looking at on slide number 7 and number 8. Particularly just looking for a little elaboration on the test strategy, specifically with the groups of targets to test. Has there been an analysis of what kind of numbers those targets total? And how does that number compare to the number of tests we are seeing done in Minnesota presently?
Mr. Hupp.
Madam Chair, Representative. So as far as our testing capacity goes, we are continuing to evaluate that. We're doing a survey every day with the various labs in the state that are currently conducting testing for this virus, for the virus that causes COVID-19. Mayo right now, as a reference lab, has the highest capacity, but Hennepin Healthcare has increased their capacity, as have you know, Fairview, many of the different healthcare groups.
I can't give you a number of, well, actually, I think we have a capacity to do a significant number of tests. However, the concern is the long-term supply chain issues. And so there's just concern about making sure that we don't run out and still can test for these priority populations. As far as the number of these priority populations, yes, we've begun to gather that number. I don't have that right now. And there are some limitations. For example, we know how many healthcare workers there are, or rather, we know how many people work in healthcare. We don't know how many people are actually in direct patient care. So, for example, when we prioritize healthcare workers, we want to prioritize those who are in direct contact with patients more than, say, someone who is administrative or some other type of part of the healthcare system. Did that answer your question sufficiently, sir?
I'm hopeful that a number, sorry, Madam Chair, yes, thank you. That I'm hopeful to hear a number soon. I know you have to gather more data, but that's certainly a question we have to address if we're going to have a strategy that mitigates so that we can be looking to see what our numbers of testing are so that we can continue to expand going back to a more an economy that we can work with. People are talking about sending more people back to work, and yet we don't have the testing to target those vulnerable communities. That's a big concern. And Madam Chair, if I may ask one more question.
Representative Pierre Mann.
Thank you, Madam Chair. This would be in reference to, I think it was Dr. Toler who mentioned the issue of a lot of our supplies we need for care being burned through at a relatively fast pace. And as this continues, my question goes to that supply issue. I read recently the U of M analysis on the raw materials for supplies, not just for testing, but for essential care of critical patients. And as those supply chains abroad have slowed down or disappeared, does it make any sense, and anyone on the panel can respond to this, does it make any sense to have a more national response in the United States to address these supply chains of critical raw materials? And something like the Defense Production Act is thrown out there a lot, but would that help? Because I just questioned whether Minnesota has the raw materials to bring the need to meet the need. So I'd like to hear some comment on that, please.
All right. Well, Representative Bierman, in this format, it's really hard to sort of throw a question out to everyone.
Okay.
So why don't we, let's see, why don't we kind of go back through the list? If you could each just answer briefly, and it's okay not to answer as well if this isn't your thing, but Mr. Beck or Dr. Maurice, do you want to take a stab at that first?
Yes, Madam Chair, I think the question with regard to supplies has been a challenging one. I think for all of the providers in the state, as well as people across the country, I think it's fair to say that there has not been strong national coordination of supply production and distribution, which has meant that there's spotty availability of supplies across the United States, and most of the individual healthcare systems and governments have wound up having to compete with one another to access what supplies currently exist.
Okay, thank you. Thanks for being brief. Dr. Toler, do you want to?
Madam Chair, happy to answer. So to the first, very important point of Representative Bierman there, by estimate, there have been about 145,000 people tested in the United States. Minnesota is number 24. With 37,421 as of this morning. The supply, that's sort of the landscape. The supply chain, I always believed, that you create your own future by your own independence. So that's why we have created enough supplies, and we are making in the serology the protein, the spike protein, that is the target of that immune response here on campus. And as this morning, I have about 100,000 worth allotment, and capacity for this. And I don't have to wait until I have somebody, state or federal, tell me, this is your ration. This is what you get and nothing more. From the molecular again, the same thing. This is my field. My lab is a molecular biology lab. You know, this is not a complicated reaction. You know, this is really, you know, a very, very standard, you know, procedure. And many, many other, you know, there are many kits, you know, that can be put together, have to be validated, of course. And just very recently, we've been able to, with some of the unbelievable people, you know, that I work with, we have been able to streamline the process so that we don't have a bottleneck in the extraction side of the nucleic acid, but rather can go directly and making the PCR through this. So there are many, many ways of not being dependent and left, you know, behind, you know, that we can rely of our own resilience in the state of Minnesota.
All right. Thank you. Dr. Hoodie, did you want to weigh in as well? I think you're still muted.
Madam Chair, can you hear me now?
Yes, now we can. Yes.
Madam Chair and Representative, I would agree with Mr. Beck and Dr. Tolar. Collection media continue to be the supply bottleneck at this point. We have more capacity to run PCR testing on our machines for specimens that are sent to us. We have collection media in-house that will last us a month or two, but we have the same issue in that we're competing with others for needed supplies. Thank you, Madam Chair.
All right. Well, thank you. So, members, let me just give you the landscape here. I know you can all see what hands are raised, but you can't see the order of them. So we are collecting that. So we've got Mann, Cantrell, Grunhagen, Knorr, Moran, and then Keel. So just to give you an idea, we have quite a few people who want to ask questions. We can go a little bit beyond our normal ending time, I'm told. So I think we could go till 2:30, but we still have to, even with that deadline, I don't know if our testifiers can stay that long. So I think we should probably assume that it's 2:15 and try to keep our questions and our answers brief. So Representative Mann, you're up next.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Huck, did you say that the molecular testing has an up to 70% false rate?
Mr. Huck.
Madam Chair, Representative, yes. Now, that is based upon sample collection, the way the sample is collected, as well as just what is the viral load of the individual. This is based upon it's an unpublished paper, pre-review paper out of Mayo, and I'm basing this.
Representative Mann?
Thank you, Madam Chair. And are other labs seeing the same false negative percentages?
Maybe since that came, since Mr. Huff referenced a Mayo paper, I don't know if one of our Mayo testifiers could address that.
Yeah, this is Dr. Maurice. Madam Chair, happy to address that. Really, as has been said by others on the call very well, you know, it's quite dependent on both the nature of the specimen collection as well as the date, you know, how far along the individual is in their course of infection, which will then speak to their viral load. I'm confident that all the methods that we're using in terms of in-lab specificity will be very high and sensitivity, but the pre-analytical variable that, could, you know, we can only detect what's in the specimen. So we do see quite a bit of variation, particularly with the nasal swabs, particularly with the drive-up collection centers and other places where you have people who aren't quite used to getting those specimens.
And Dr. Tolar, it looked like you wanted to say something as well. Do you want to chime in? Oh, you're still muted. Oh, wait, we're not hearing you yet.
Madam Chair.
Now you are.
Yeah, so I'm not in charge of the mute button, you know, so that's I'm not
that's
hesitant.
Quite all right.
I'm not shy. Madam Chair, yes, I do. I would like to add that we do know how to control for the conditions of the reaction, and a classic, you know, extraction and the PCR reaction should be possible with the standard operating procedure whereby you collect the nasal pharyngeal swab and process it, you know, all that. This should be much lower number of the false negatives, in my opinion.
All right, thank you very much. Representative Cantrell.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you to all the testifiers. I think we are really fortunate in Minnesota to have so many leading experts in the field of healthcare. And Dr. Tolar, your research in regenerative medicine and CRISPR-Cas9 genome editing has been very incredible. But my question is to whomever would like to answer it. Mr. Hoff, I think might be, or Hoff might be able to answer this. You mentioned herd immunity. So what I think would be beneficial for everybody, I think there's a little bit of misconception and misunderstanding around what herd immunity is. So if anybody would be willing to explain what herd immunity is, explain how it differs from just having the entire population get sick at once. And then if somebody could please speak to the notion that there are some people who are suggesting it's time to send kids back to school, teachers back to school, staff back to school to develop herd immunity. And if somebody could just kind of delineate for us why we were to do that quickly and try to force herd immunity to develop quickly within the population, why that would be a ruinous approach. So if anybody would be willing to take that question.
All right. Thank you, Representative Cantrell. I'm going to ask just Mr. Huff, if you can, to address that pretty briefly, because we could talk about this for a very long time, and I don't want to pull this hearing way off track. But Mr. Huff, if you could address that.
Yes, Madam Chair. So herd immunity is when enough people are immune to a virus, either through a vaccine or actually exposure to that pathogen itself and recovery, that they are immune from that or resistant to it. Once enough people are, the virus just doesn't have as many people to go around, I guess. So generally we think of if you get 90% of the people who are immune to something, the virus can't really spread like wildfire. So you think of all the dry tinder is now wet down because people have antibody immunity. Now you talked about, let's just get all herd immunity at once. I go back to my analogy on the mountain. We have to go down the mountain slowly. If we go down too fast, we'll crash through the guardrail, which means that we will crash our healthcare system. It's also important to remember we get herd immunity because when people are exposed to the virus, they either survive and have immunity or they die. And we want to limit fatality and mortality as much as possible. That's why it's so important we go down the mountain slowly.
All right. Thank you very much for that. So we've got Representative Grunhagen, Knorr, Moran, and Keel. Representative Grunhagen.
Oh, thank you, Madam Chair. Yeah, my question is for the medical doctors. I've heard from several doctors, healthcare workers, and I even interviewed a microbiologist who had 35 years experience in the pharmaceutical industry. And their opinion so far has been that we could open up this economy that's, you know, between essential versus non-essential and call all businesses essential and then practice you know, safe behaviors like social distancing, wash your hand, et cetera, and then protect our most vulnerable, like those in the nursing home, but not cripple the economy the way it is now. This has become quite a bone of contention, and just wanted to hear from the medical side what your thoughts are about that.
So, Representative Grunhagen, I appreciate that the question is one that many people are interested in. However, it's really not the topic of this hearing. And we are really focused on testing. And I realize that it is related to testing. The kind of our point here is what kind of testing do we have and what do we need to get us where we all want to go, which is going back to reopening our economy. But, you know, I don't want to get us into what could become a political discussion here or one person's kind of opinion about the bigger issue. So, you know, if we can defer that question, I would like to do that so that we can focus on testing and get through the hearing and let all the members get their questions answered. Did you have something, closely related to the issue here that you'd like to ask?
Well, Madam Chair, try to make it a topic in the future. It is a growing issue out in the public, I think. And I think just about all representatives have heard from the public on this. And I think we need to be come with a clear answer on this. And I think the public would appreciate it.
Yeah. Thank you, Representative Grunhagen. I appreciate that. And you know what? We will think about how to do that. And a part of that will be having the right people in the room, so to speak, so that we can have a good discussion about that with all of the viewpoints we would need to hear from. So thank you very much for that. Next on the list is Representative Knorr. Representative Knorr. There, we're not hearing you. I can see you talking, but I can't hear you yet. Oh, we need to unmute Representative Knorr. Oh. Okay, we're still not getting you. Something's going on here. What if we go on to Representative Moran, and then we'll come back to Representative Knorr, if that's okay. Representative Moran.
Yes, Representative Liebling, can you hear me?
Yes.
Okay, thank you. So my question is around testing with Mr. Huff, who's with MDH, in relationship to Dr. Hoodie. So MDH stated that testing is the priorities around the vulnerable populations, which would be the healthcare, patients over 65, childcare worker, and those who are now serving vulnerable populations. And versus Dr. Hoodie, who talked about the vulnerable populations being those who are homeless and communities of color. For me, it's particularly those from the Black community that we see around the country who are being disproportionately impacted and are dying. And so I'm just wondering why the message from MDH is not having the looking at the Black community who are at high risk for pre-existing conditions to not be a priority list for MDH. So if Mr. Huff can talk about that, that would be helpful for me for testing.
Mr. Huff,
if we're here.
Mr. Huff, please.
Madam Chair, Representative, thank you for raising that question, because we do know, because of our health disparities, which impact people of color more than white folks, that people of color are more at risk for something like a virus like COVID. And as you noted, nationwide, we are seeing disproportionate impact in our communities of color. It is definitely an issue that we're looking at. We do believe that we have undersampling and other folks are not being tested in some of these communities as much as we need to have them. We definitely want to increase our testing. And you're right, we should look at that as part of our criteria for a vulnerable population, because if you do have pre-existing conditions, whether it be from health disparities or whatever, if you have pre-existing conditions, you are more vulnerable to this disease, for severe disease. So thank you for raising that issue.
Representative Moran?
Yes, thank you, Chair Liebling. So for the Department of Health, who is the Department of Health, it would be helpful to hear you use that language in describing who are the vulnerable populations, because folks from the Black community across the state of Minnesota are showing up to be tested and are being sent home. So I need the Department of Health to be the messenger of that message, as so as you are with the other populations that you have named.
Okay. Thank you, Representative Moran. Back to Representative Knorr. Can we get you now?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I think you can hear me now.
Yes.
Madam Chair and members, I think part of my question has been asked by Representative Moran. Thank you for raising that issue. Staying at home is a privilege. Social distancing is a privilege. We know the virus is not an equalizer because it's impacting many people who are low income. We know the data. So the question is, are we tracking the number of people that we're telling them to stay at home, where they're being diagnosed by, you know, through telehealth process or telemedicine by their doctors? Do we have any data to show how many people who are being told to stay at home are not being tested?
I think that would be for Mr. Huff.
Madam Chair, I'm sorry. If I understood the question correctly, Representative, it was, do we have data on people who are able to stay home versus those who, because of other factors, social distancing and shelter in place, are more difficult?
Representative Knorr?
Yes, Madam Chair, that is correct.
Mr. Huff, do you have that?
So, Madam Chair, I do not have that. I do know that we have one of the gubernatorial work groups is on vulnerable populations. People experiencing homelessness is one that we are really concerned about because of that very reason. And I would have to refer you to my colleagues who are leading that group.
Okay, Representative Knorr, anything further?
Thank you, Madam Chair.
All right, thank you. So I have now Keel and then Representative Franson. Representative Keel.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I would like to know, I live in, first of all, for anybody who doesn't know, I live in rural Minnesota. So we are not seeing much of COVID-19 at all, although I guess we have a second case now in Polk County, which is a fairly large county. But with regard to the testing, if we were to send children back as the testing improves to school, say senior high kids, can we have some way to manage that by testing, or is there just no way to allow those kids to go back to school, protecting teachers and, of course, staff in some way? But I'm just wondering, in the future, how can we test and get people back to work too? I've got hairdressers, I've got all kinds of people that can be one-on-one, or, you know, we have a lot of space. So that's what I'd like to know, is how we can manage that with testing.
Yeah, thank you, Representative Keel. And I think that's probably a good one to give to Mr. Huff. And I think that is sort of the central question is, you know, we can, mm-hmm. we've got testing, or we may, or we have some, maybe not enough, but how can we utilize it for the best bang for the buck, so to speak, in Minnesota to get things moving again? So, Mr. Huff, can you address that? And I'm going to actually ask the other testifiers, too, if they'd like to weigh in on that, if you could be a little bit brief. Mr. Huff, you first.
Madam Chair, Representative, yes, the idea of testing is it allows us to do disease investigation, to have people that are infected to isolate so they don't spread the disease, to have the people they have been in contact to quarantine so if they develop the disease, they do not spread it. So it is an effective public health strategy. It is more difficult once we have widespread community spread, which we are in now, but it can still help slow the spread of the disease and allow us to be more strategic in our measures.
All right, thank you. Does Mr. Beck or Dr. Maurice, did you want to weigh in on that?
Yes, Madam Chairman, thank you for the opportunity. I think, first of all, as Dr. Tolar pointed out, you know, we don't know, and also Dr. Hoodie, we don't know enough yet about what being seroconversion and Mr. Huff, what seroconversion really means for durable immunity. I think we have to understand some of those things before we can really answer the questions everyone wants answered, including Representative Keel. I do think, though, thinking back to Dr. Hoodie's comments, one of the real needs for testing, which has been raised, particularly in our vulnerable communities that will not be able to practice social distancing, there will be other mitigation efforts. The convalescent Anacera program, which we're part of, is just a part. We might actually want to focus some of those efforts on those who will not be able to practice social distancing so they don't spread this in their communities. So I think it's critically important that we're testing all Minnesotans, particularly those who are vulnerable, who would really feel the ravages of this disease because they can't socially distance themselves. And because of healthcare disparities, they also have many comorbidities.
All right. Thank you. Dr. Tolar? Oh, we can't hear you. Sorry.
Oh, now there we go. Madam Chair. I only two small comments because, you know, all of relevance has been said, but they are important to add. One is that the two-part test, the pair test of the molecular and serology, is very important. Taking one or the other in isolation will not give us the information that we need. And the second is that the the spread of the testing needs to be, in my opinion, done in a strategic way, as Mr. Huff said. But what it means is that you go to tailored communities. You say, this is for nursing homes. You know, this is for our food plants. This is what I'm going to do in Crookston. This is what I'm going to do, you know, inner city. And in that way, you are able to cohort people and isolate the contacts in a much better way than otherwise.
Okay, thank you. Dr. Hoodie. Okay, hold on one sec here. The technology does not move at the speed of our conversation. Can we?
Madam Chair, can you hear me?
Now we can, yes, thank you.
Madam Chair, Representative, I would agree with what Dr. Toler and Mr. Huff said. Given the reliability concerns with serology, at least in the short term, for PCR testing for congregate areas that don't have rapid turnaround time, it seems reasonable, and we have the capability actually to provide turnaround times under 24 hours within the Twin Cities area for those areas. And so it seems that, at least in the short term, that if there is, for those areas that aren't able to practice social distancing, that it would be imperative to get all of those areas up to the ability to have this testing in short turnaround time to mitigate spread in tight settings. Thank you.
Okay, thank you very much. So I have Representative Franson and then Haley. Representative Franson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So I'm not sure if these questions will be able to answer today, but I just wanted on the record. Regarding the testing, how that's going to work. So is everybody going to be required to be tested? And then where is that data going to be held, or what will be used with that data? Is there DNA that's going to also be collected and stored? And if somebody does not pass, there is no immunity, they don't have the antibodies, will they be denied the ability to work? So those are questions that I have. And then regarding herd immunity, how can we actually have a natural herd immunity to the COVID-19 if we are not allowed to be out in public with others?
So Representative Franson, I think some of those questions are really policy questions that probably can't be answered in this context, as you noted. I do think there's a one that maybe we can ask if any of our testifiers can tell us anything about sort of the storage of the data, or, you know, is people's particular individual genetic information being captured? What happens to the information that we get when somebody gets a test? Can anybody... you know, maybe some of you who are doing the testing can address that. And maybe it's different in different institutions as well. I don't know. Let's see, who wants to start on that one? Mr. Beck, do you want to take that?
Yeah, Madam Chair, I think it's a good question. And it's going to fall normally to the relationship between the patient and the healthcare provider regarding the information that is kept as a part of their medical record. I think I would speak for most laboratories that would say that the blood that would be taken or the swab that's taken in the media is normally kept on hand after the test for a number of days, whether it's 7 to 14 days, in case a retest is necessary. But in most cases, then the media is discarded or otherwise anonymized.
Okay. And Dr. Toler, I see you raising your hand there. If we could unmute him.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, whoever controls the button. I'm just going to add that this is very common for us. This is our day job, you know, to protect the information of the patient to lead the highest ethical standards, you know, in protecting the personal health information. And we are very, all the institutions that you have represented it on the panel, you know, are very, very accustomed to do this right. There's one additional point to be made, which is Mayo Clinic and University of Minnesota, a number of organizations in the state of Minnesota, are very good with data analytics. So this is a obviously anonymized, you know, this is never can be connected back to you, but it does serve a purpose whereby by machine learning and artificial intelligence, we can import a way of looking at the data that is not typically because of intensity or scale or just sheer mass of data available to any human brain alone. And we have been very, you know, advancing, you know, this kind of a approach to the data as well. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you. And I wonder if Mr. Huff, I don't know if this may be sort of a surprise question too, but since the public health lab is doing some of the testing, could you just address that? You know, what happens to people's individual data from the point of view of the tests that are done at the public health lab?
Yes, Madam Chair. So we are extremely protective of all individual data that comes to the public health lab. We do not disclose any information, and we don't track information on individuals beyond the you know certain tests that we have. So unlike a medical clinic, we don't have your full medical record. We know that the test came in and what that test is, whether it's positive or negative. So we do this all the time for diseases that people have in Minnesota. And then our epidemiologists work to follow up with that person to make sure they're in a safe environment, make sure they're getting the care they need, and to also make sure that they're not infecting others. So we don't keep data past that for individuals. We keep it, as Dr. Tolek said, more as an aggregate, as here's a lot of broad data points, but they're not associated with individuals.
And Mr. Huff, do you report it back to the provider if it was sent in to you from a clinic or a hospital? Do you just report the result back to the provider? Is that how that works?
Absolutely. So we get the minimal identifying information. We get the name and the date of birth, and then we send that back to whoever took the sample, whatever clinician provided us that.
Okay, excellent. Okay, we have Representative Haley on the list.
Thank you, Madam Chair, for holding the hearing, and thank you to all the testifiers, for you and your staffs for the work that you're doing to help us understand this disease and keep us safe. You have our appreciation. I think it was Dr. Tolar that said, you used the phrase, Minnesota is in a position to rely on ourselves. I'm wondering if you can elaborate on that. And all of you have obviously talked about the supply chain issue in order to get us to full testing capacity. But I'm asking you, I guess, before we end this hearing, can you connect the dots for me one more time on what are the steps to do that? We have such tremendous resources here, and I just want to leave this hearing today understanding kind of A, B, C, D. What needs to happen so that we don't have a supply and we can move full speed ahead, relying on Minnesota itself to test our population for this disease? Thank you so much.
Right. Thank you, Representative Haley. If we can unmute Dr. Tolar again, that's an excellent question. Dr. Tolar.
Madam Chair, Representative Haley, this is an excellent question. What I meant to imply is that in times of scarcity and stress, it pays a lot to be prepared for the worst case scenario and really, you know, build from within, you know, autonomous, independent resources whereby we can then use to respond. We have been able, I think, to take the concept of the capacity. So what we have in Minnesota is quite unbelievable. I'm extremely proud of the knowledge that exists in this space in the state of Minnesota. It's not just Mayo, not just University of Minnesota, not just Hennepin. It is really the healthcare companies and a lot of other people and organizations that are here. What we don't have is ability yet to take that capacity, the potential energy of having all of these seams of energy and put it into action, into the kinetic energy. We have started there, and this panel and this this leadership around this virtual table is exactly how to do it. So what I meant by that is that you can, because of science and technology, because of that knowledge that we have in the state of Minnesota, one can deconstruct things in a way that others can't. You know, when we are talking about testing, but you know, when we went and didn't have the vents and we went to a toolbox and an embu bag and made a ventilator out of this, or when we made a face mask from origami from a rolls of paper, that is different approach to going on Google or whatever, Amazon, I don't want to put anybody in the bad position, and trying to find where am I going to buy my next supply. You know, this is more adaptive, you know, more sort of self-efficient, you know, kind of way of doing this. And I maintain, even though I don't see, nobody can see the end of the epidemic, because that is something of an agile system. You can predict 2-3 weeks ahead, not 3 months or 3 years ahead, because that's it's like weather. What I can tell you is that the supplies at the moment in the parts, you know, that I can have a visibility over are such that we should be independent for the large part to provide the testing for Minnesotans.
All right, great. And I'd like to ask Mr. Huff, too, if you can address that, because, you know, obviously, I mean, it is really, I must say, very impressive to hear from all of you. And I know that Minnesotans, I hope a lot of them watch this hearing, because they should be very, very proud of what we have in this state. And Mr. Huff, I'd like to ask you from a statewide perspective to try to address that question, if you could. Not that that hasn't been from a statewide, but I think you're in a different position.
Madam Chair, yes. We actually have, as part of the statewide response at the State Emergency Operations Center, we have a staff person who's full-time dedicated to lab supply issues. He's working with members of all of our labs in the state to find out what are their limiting factors and how do we get those, either through bulk purchasing or, to Dr. Tolar's point, we're actually working with a manufacturer here in Minnesota to develop the right type of swabs that we need. So we're doing everything we can from the state perspective to supply the needs of our Minnesota labs.
Great. Well, thank you for that. So we have one final question. It is 2:12 by my clock here. So I'm going to give the last question to Representative Mann, and then we will finish up. Representative Mann.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I have a question for Mr. Beck. If we're doing 7,500 tests per day, it seems like if someone is in your system, they are able to get tested and go through your channels. But if they're not in the Mayo system, are you offering those capabilities to other smaller hospital systems who are not able to do in-house testing? And if so, is that, do you donate those services or do you charge for those services?
Mr. Beck. Yep, Madam Chair, Representative Mann, thank you for the question. I think it's a twofold. One is we obviously are taking care of the patients within our own healthcare system with our internal capacity, and we also have the external capacity through Mayo Clinic Laboratories to offer those services outside of our own institution. The way we prioritized the opening of those services was first with the state of Minnesota, then with primary and secondary clients within the state of Minnesota. And then we opened up that capacity to our clients outside the state of Minnesota. And so that's how we have prioritized opening up that capacity on the molecular side and how we prioritized opening up that capacity on the serology side. If what I would say then is for healthcare systems who want to be able to bring that testing in-house, we actually think that's a really good thing. And have assisted people as a part of our own business model with bringing testing in-house. Because in most cases, having the testing done more closely to the patient is the better alternative than having the test sent off to a commercial lab provider.
All right. Well, thank you very much. So we are just perfectly on time here to finish up. And I again, on behalf of all the members, I can just see that everyone is really paying close attention. This is incredibly important to our state, to all of us, to our families, to our entire country, and to the world. So we are, as I said, extremely grateful to have such amazing resources within Minnesota, including our excellent Department of Health and all of our organizations, Mayo Clinic, University of Minnesota, Hennepin Health, and so many other really wonderful providers and companies and people who are really stepping up. So our deepest appreciation to all of you for being here today. This will definitely not be the last time we're discussing this and other related topics that have been brought up by members and how we're going to move forward on this. And with that, I will close this hearing. Thank you all very much.